Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Peter Caddick Adams talking about the Paris peace treaties.
What I want to do this morning is just sort of confirm what you understand by the post-First World War peace treaty arrangements, and then dive into actually challenging some of the sort of understanding we have over what goes on in the immediate aftermath of the First World War and for the next sort of half decade, the 5 years following. I actually speak with several sort of different hats. One is having served as a soldier, but in contested areas, the like of which would have been similar to Europe in 1918, 1919. I spent a while in Bosnia in the aftermath of the civil war there, and more recently in Iraq and Afghanistan. The immediate post-war era is important to us because the fighting doesn't stop. You will understand that we have an armistice, that peace in some form or other is declared, and I'll dive into that in a minute. In fact, for the next 5 years, the fighting carries on in lots of parts of Europe, and it all depends where you are and what your supposed nationality is to give you some idea of what peace is. So it's a relative term, and that's a useful one to throw back at the examiners, were you so minded. So Winston Churchill dismisses the ongoing wars after the First World War as the Wars of Pygmies, but in fact that costs another 4 million lives killed by violent death in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. So it's not quite as easily compartmentalised as war, peace, interwar period, Second World War. And as I want to suggest to you at the end, those who are perpetrating the genocides and the brutal violence of the Second World War are those who are caught up and often perpetrating or brought up in the era of violence after the First World War, but while the killing continues over the next few years. So we understand that Woodrow Wilson has put together his 14 points, initially they gain not so much traction with the Germans, but once the German field forces start to be beaten roundly, fairly and squarely on the main scene of battle in Western Europe, the Western Front, peace negotiations open up, and in fact it's the Austro-Hungarians who surrender first, and British forces in Italy are the first to enter the territorial areas of the Central Powers, and this is what we understand by Turkey, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, and the Bulgarians. So the first time their territory is trodden on by, or entered by the Western powers is actually by British forces fighting alongside our Italian allies, they're on our side in the First World War, in 1918. Well, it's not so long after that that the representatives meet in the famous rail carriage at Compiègne to hammer out the final terms of what is the armistice. And an armistice, of course, is a truce. It's a term that goes back hundreds of years, in which you then tease out the finer points of your negotiation. It means during the time of truce, the fighting is meant to stop. And we use that as shorthand for saying that's the end of the First World War. It isn't. So the armistice is simply a temporary means to explore exactly how you want to hammer out your terms of peace. So to say that it's peace is to be preemptive, and it will take until June the following year before the final deal is hammered out, and we know that as the Treaty of Versailles. Now, the threat to the Germans is always that if you don't negotiate seriously, or we can't find an agreement, we will go back to war. And that is a real threat breathing down the Germans' neck. Of course, they're suffering civil disorder, communist takeovers, insurrection amongst the armies, and in their various major cities. But it's not a threat that would have been taken that seriously, I think, because the Allied armies are rapidly demobilizing. You've got to send all those millions of men home who've been put into uniform and conscripted from every fighting nation. So we embark on a rapid process of demobilization at the same time as threatening the Germans with continued war. So it's probably an empty promise and they realize it. Nevertheless, we have to send everyone home. That requires huge logistics and huge military machinery, useful that it's already in place, just to send everyone home and shoehorn them back into civilian life. With them is, of course, accompanied the beginnings of what we call the Spanish flu epidemic. In fact, it's a pandemic. It goes right around the world. And we often forget that if we assess the First World War as costing 17 million lives caused by violent death, the flu pandemic, which erupts really in 1918 and lasts for a couple of years, around the world costs a minimum of 20 million deaths. Now, the flu triggers other medical conditions like tuberculosis, pneumonia and so on, already pre-existing, and hastens the death of perhaps 30 million more. So the best guesstimate is the flu costs us between 20 and 50 million deaths in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. And the popular notion is that these are the old or the young, the infirm and the weak. In fact, the largest body of people who die because of flu are the young men who've survived the trenches, and it's the fit and the healthy and the young, and predominantly male, who suffer because of flu. Where it comes from, the virus for the medics is called H1N1, which is still around today. And this is haunting us as a spectre because we don't quite know where it came from and we don't know quite what caused it to peter out. And it's still a virus that changes and mutates and bubbles up every now and again. It's clearly related to bird flu, and we think by large numbers of soldiers eating chickens and chickens being stored next to pigs, which we were also eating all the pork and bacon, some kind of virus mutated from large numbers of chickens and turkeys into the pigs that all the armies ate and then were ingested and absorbed into the human food chain. Now, in 1916, a lot of armies, not just British medics, but medical officers with the French, the Belgians, never mind the Germans, are reporting strains of fevers, which they write off under the general term of trench fever. Now, there is a body of thought today which suggests that may be the early strains of what was called the Spanish flu. It's simply reported in the Spanish press first, so that's why it's called Spanish flu. It's nothing to do with the Spanish at all. So the doubts about the origin are significant because it could have grown out of the trenches of the First World War, but the impact after the war is huge. Far greater in terms of deaths than the number of people killed in the First World War, and the worry about it is still with us today. But again, we largely forget about it. You don't get exam questions on the Spanish flu of 1919 like you do on the causes or the aftermath of the First World War. So the Treaty of Versailles is the result of endless compromises because the Allied powers all want something different. How punitive are you going to be? And the French realize if you are going to be terribly punitive, you're going to continue the aggression, the tension between France and Germany. But on the other hand, they need some kind, they need to be seen to be arguing for significant recompense because it's mostly France that's been laid to waste. And it's France of all the Allied forces that has bled in terms of not just killed manpower, but all the mutilated soldiers who you will see on every street corner in France during the interwar period. So the French government has to play to the populist vote of demanding perhaps more than they realise they should from Germany, largely in terms of money, and largely in terms not of paper money, but of gold. And if gold can't be supplied, then raw materials. The Versailles Treaty is overseen largely by Woodrow Wilson, and as soon as it's over, he departs back from the United States, rather like in a sort of Olympian god. And that's resented in Europe, and he doesn't hang around to manage the aftermath. Having set up the concept of the League of Nations, as we will see, America then neglects to play a part in it. And that leaves a bitter taste in the mouth, because we are in 1919 where we are today with America in terms of not quite understanding what their foreign policy is and where it's going. And so again, I, as a professional historian, I fully believe that there are big wheels in history that come round, and the same tensions are there unless they're managed and addressed, and even if they do, they pop up again. So this is what Versailles really spawns. It's not one, but five main treaties, because we've not got just one of the Central Powers to deal with. Germany, we've also got Austria-Hungary, we've got the Ottoman Empire, we've got the Bulgarians, and Austria-Hungary clearly being split into two. So that gives us sort of five treaties, all of which need to be changed and adapted. And you can see the date of signing, it isn't all 1919. This process stretches into 1920, is revised in 1923, and I suppose the last of our bevy of treaties might be in Locarno, which is 1925. So it's a long, drawn-out process. It's inherited from the process of 100 years earlier in the aftermath of the Napoleonic era, where everyone gets together to try and hammer out a peace settlement, which doesn't quite work. Either it's interrupted by the return of Napoleon. Now, I've mentioned that the Germans have got to settle with the French, largely the French, but the other allies as well, in cash. The Germans, when they go to war in 1914, the Kaiser, his personal decision, is to fund the war effort by borrowing. You can do it in two ways. You can either borrow, or you can raise the money to fund the war by tax, by taxation, raising the level of income tax. Now, that's the preferred route that the British and many other powers take. The gamble, of course, if you fund it by borrowing, is at the end of the war you've got to return the money. You don't know what money will be like. You don't know how stable your own currency will be. You don't know what the inflation rate will be like. And it presupposes that your money is going to be worth a lot because you will have won the war. So Germany is faced with a huge whammy in 1918 when the armistice is concluded and then the peace is signed, because Germany has lost the war and already is already pretty much bankrupt, because it can't repay the loans it took out to fund the war in the first place. On top of that comes the requirement to pay back in terms of compensation to the winning countries. And therefore, Germany is faced with a double whammy and completely unable to pay. Hence, we get, as early as 1922, hyperinflation, where the value of the mark, which was round about, was extremely stable before the First World War, around about 5 marks to the dollar, by 1922, it's well over 5 billion to the dollar. It's a bit like the currency in Zimbabwe at the moment. Now, these banknotes from the 1920s, from 1923, illustrate the problem. Here we've got a banknote for 50,000 marks. It's out of, before it's even issued as a banknote, inflation has ripped it to pieces. And you can see the overprint, the cancellation here, and the overprint that this is now 5 million marks rather than 50,000. Because inflation, just in the few weeks between printing and issuing, has degraded German currency that much. We've got notes here for 50 billion marks, for 500 billion marks. And that's how much and how rampant German inflation becomes. It largely destroys the middle class and certainly their savings in early 1920s Germany. This is before the Nazis come to power. The important point is that recent analysis of German economic activity suggests that it was the Germans themselves who deliberately triggered the inflation as a way of devaluing their currency, because they knew they wouldn't be able to pay the French. So it's partly circumstance, it's partly the Germans' own machinations, but it does destroy their own middle class and paves the way for what we know will happen next. And this is one of the problems. When we look at 20th century German history, it's dominated by what happens in the middle of the 20th century, and everything, and the way we study history is completely altered by what we know is going to happen next. We have to put ourselves in the minds of those in the 1920s who have no idea what's over the horizon and hope that the Great War has taught everyone a lesson and there won't be a resurgence of fighting again. There is a breath of fresh air in 1925 when the French, the Brits, the Germans, the Americans get together and sign the so-called Locarno Accords, which is a different kind of set of treaties. It's looking forward rather than back, and it acknowledges that Franco-German tension can't go on for any longer, and so the Allies set in stone, the Western Allies set in stone, the fact that Germany's frontiers in the West are recognised, will not be altered, and that the French won't make endless calls on Germany for reparations. The final reparations the French will get is 15 years worth of coal from the Saar region, and then that's all done and dusted. However, it does leave open Germany's eastern frontiers with all of the countries in the east, and that's where most of the problem is going to lie. But it is security for France. It's also, if you like, wiping the slate clean as much as you can with the Germans and hoping to move on. But it's signed with the Weimar Republic, of course, and that is all about to change fairly soon. This is the key point about the League of Nations. And we often say the League of Nations failed. There are 12 aspects to the League of Nations in terms of the different departments it sets up. I always like to turn that question on its head. The standard exam question is, why did the League of Nations fail? It's quite useful and instructive if you take the why out of that question. Did the League of Nations fail? Because you can actually come up with an alternative answer and say, no, it didn't. 8 out of the 12 aspects of the League of Nations, the bodies, the cultural, educational organisations, the health organisations, later find their way into today's United Nations. And if you have a score of 8 out of 10 bodies that were part of the old League of Nations carrying on into the United Nations of today, to my mind, that's not a complete failure. However, in preventing war, quite clearly, the League does fail. And we can see that largely because of American isolationism, which the cartoon here so well hints at. The other aspect I think we need to place that sort of interwar peace-dealing process in is everything else that's going on artistically and culturally. What we have, of course, is a complete disillusionment with monarchies and democracies all the way through Europe, because they have failed because they allowed the First World War to happen. And it doesn't matter how you tease through that process of how the First World War erupted and what happened, the widespread populist view in every country is we've all suffered. We've suffered an extreme number of violent deaths, never mind everyone who's been wounded. Our countries have been ruined. A lot of borders have been changed. That was because monarchies and liberal democracies allowed this to happen. Therefore, in the future, what we need to do is look for other things. And people begin to experiment with other political ideologies. I'll come to that in a minute. But it changes your thoughts on everything, on art, on culture, on literature, every aspect of the fine arts. So the fussy architecture of the Victorian and Edwardian era is replaced by what we loosely call Art Deco. But all these sort of clean lines, and whether it's architecture, whether it's furniture design, whether it's art itself. You see it in the travel posters. You see it in even designs for wallpaper, never mind furniture, never mind clothing. It's instructive to realise that the two illustrations, the tiles on a French railway station depicting fashion in 1909, is separated by only 20 years with this magazine front cover. And the contrast couldn't be greater. And that is people rejecting the past. Just as they do politically, they're doing it in every other respect. And we arrive at this well-known sort of series of styles, Art Deco, but it's all part of the same process. If you look back at what the world was like 20 years earlier and then you fast forward, there's an enormous gulf, and it's because a whole generation has simply said, God, you know, if that stood for the system that allowed the First World War to happen, we don't want any more of it at all, and everything changes. And I can't think of another period in history where we have such radical change in every aspect of our lives, visually and intellectually. The first sort of hint of warning in the future is Mussolini. Sergeant Mussolini fights in the First World War, is a rabid socialist before the war breaks out, becomes a nationalist because he's patriotically fighting for Italy. And he sees the great threat in Italy as one of communism, and so he mobilizes his various mates and political cronies. They march on Rome in 1922, and rather to his surprise, and that of the rest of Italy, and indeed that of the rest of the world, the acting statesman who is the monarch of Italy, King Victor Emmanuel, offers Mussolini power. Now, he needn't have done so, but he was conservative, out of touch, and motivated by a fear of communism, which would clearly remove his monarchy, as it had done with the Russian Tsars. And Mussolini's in power. Now, when you look at his methodology, and I've put these pictures up because the whole iconography of wearing a coloured shirt, marching along, you can see the whole idea that Hitler then takes with his brown shirts and armbands and all the rest of it. But first it originates this idea of never mind National Socialism, but all the iconography, the clothing, the banners that go with it, it all originates from Italy, and this is the model that the Nazis and others use later on. It's no accident that the following year, Hitler tries to do exactly what Mussolini has done successfully in Italy, but fails in the Munich Book Beer Hall Putsch. And thereafter, we have the search for alternative ideologies which focus on National Socialism or Communism throughout the 1920s, 1930s, and that affects every other country. Now, it looks as though Europe is then stabilising. Locarno is looking forward. Franco-German relations are better. Industrial productivity is picking up. People are finding jobs. And then wham, the Wall Street crisis happens in 1929. And that wipes billions off people's savings and earnings in the United States. Mass unemployment immediately hits, and that spreads all around the world, and we're back into worse depression than we've ever been or were aware of before. And that, we could sort of say, is broadly our understanding of the First World War, its aftermath, and the impact. Now, what I want to do is just turn that upside down a little for you over the final few minutes. So we're happy about the First World War, all the war memorials up and down the United Kingdom telling us about the First World War from 1914 to 1918. But there are a significant number of war memorials in the United Kingdom that talk about the First World War being fought between 1914 and 1919. So what's going on there? Well, we send missions to Russia to fight the aid the white Russians fighting the communist Reds. And indeed elsewhere in the Middle East. So this is then confirmed by the Victory Medal, which is awarded by all the combatant nations on the Allied side, common ribbon, common design, and you can see the date there is quite clearly 1914 to 1919. So again, it underlines the point that 1918 is an armistice, a temporary halt, and in theory the fighting could carry on, and in some places it does. People are still fighting and dying in Russia and in the Middle East. So, you know, 11th of November 1918 is shorthand and actually inaccurate shorthand. Now, when we come to the British War Medal, and I'm not a sort of medal collector, but you can see the date here on the silver medal on the right is 1914 to 1918. But it's known as the British War Medal of 1914 to 1920, because the British continue to fight, particularly in the Middle East. And if we continue that theme, there's a rising in Iraq against British rule in 1921, elsewhere in the Middle East, And of course, we've still got the wars fought on the west, on the northwest frontier of India, in Afghanistan, and you can see the dates here, ranging right up to 1924. So to say the First World War, which is a group of interrelated regional conflicts, ends in 1918, is right only depending on where you're actually living at the time, and the violence carries on a lot of other places. This war memorial, it's by no means uncommon, reflects the fact that actually people are dying much later than 1918. You can fudge it and leave the dates out altogether, which is what some war memorials choose to end up doing. But it does give us an insight into the fact that it's not nearly quite as easy and done and dusted as you might first think. If you're one of the new nations, Poland reborn as a result of the Versailles Treaty, then your war has only just begun. Because as soon as Poland is created, the communist influence from Soviet Russia is trying to subvert the foundation of an independent Polish state, and the Poles are at war right from the word go. And the reminder here that from 1921 onwards, they are fighting communists or Russians or both, and there's obviously subtle differences. It is a reminder that Eastern Europe is by no means peaceable and the fighting has ceased there. You could take the German view, which is, yes, there's clearly fighting from 1914 to 1918. There's clearly a lot of unrest and you simply mark the end of the long period in 1945. I'm not sure I'd necessarily subscribe to the total of 97 million violent deaths, but something of the order of 70 to 95 would be about the right sort of figure. But I think what I'm arguing now is that 1914 unleashes a cycle of violence which doesn't stop in 1918, doesn't stop in 1919, doesn't stop in 1920. There is certainly pretty unfettered violence in Europe, mostly Eastern Europe, at least until 1923. And the guys who are doing that are then find that legitimate, and they're the perpetrators of the violence in the Second World War, and particularly some of the genocides. And I would argue that that's continuing today in places like Yugoslavia. We saw that in Bosnia 20 years ago. Still tensions there today. And we see it in Ukraine quite clearly. And there's an ongoing civil war there with roughly 10 people being killed and 30 people being wounded every day. And because that's happening on a daily basis, it's no longer dramatic, it no longer hits the headlines, but it's an active, ongoing war, perpetrated largely by the same tensions. And if we go back to sort of Eastern Europe for a second, and I said, you know, the understanding the violence depends on where you're living, we have two Balkan wars fought between the various powers in the region, Bulgaria, Romania, Greece, Serbia, and so on, over territory, and the borders shift in 1912 and again in 1913 in the aftermath of both wars. So if you live in the Balkans, substantial number of countries today, substantial populations, for you, the First World War, or the fighting, really began in 1912. And had odd intermissions while peace treaties were sort of signed and then immediately broken, and that process carries through till 1918, but there's ethnic tension and a lot of killing and slaying after. So if you live in the Balkans, the First World War of 4.5 years is a meaningless concept, because actually it's a 10-year war. And even then, it's probably not done and dusted in the 1920s. And it's just instructive to look at maps like this. This is the former Austria-Hungary. Been around for about 300 years. What can we say from this? Well, we've clearly got countries here like Bosnia, Croatia. Carniola is modern-day Slovenia. Here is Austria, here is Hungary. These are bits of Romania. Up in the north, Bohemia and Moravia, we've got the modern Czech Republic and Slovakia. Up here, you can see Krakow, that's southern Poland. What have we got over here, centered around the town of Lviv? That is actually Western Ukraine. Now, Western Ukraine was never part of Russia, was always part of Austria-Hungary. They spoke German there. Their language and culture is Western looking. They're Catholic. They're not Orthodox. They look westwards. The architecture is Western. And for Russia for the Soviet Union until 1989, and even for Putin today, to sort of say that actually, you know, really, Ukraine is part of Russia, always has been, always should be, is a complete nonsense, because half the country was always part of Austria-Hungary. And that underlines sort of some of the tensions and why the business of signing peace treaties in the immediate aftermath of the First World War with not quite the right sort of focus and resolution gives us where we are today in terms of conflict and regional tensions. On that moment, I'll stop, and I hope what we might be able to do is just tease a few issues out in questions. But I hope what I've done is just sort of turn a few sort of basic truths of the First World War a little bit on their heads and given you a sort of more of an elastic notion of that period of history. Okay, stunned silence. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.